But before we do that, just a few words about the text. The text of the Bahman Sutra. It is quite a short work, and it consists of a number of apparently unconnected paragraphs. It doesn't read smoothly and continuously, apparently, one topic leading on to the next. You get a bit of this and a bit of that, without any apparent order or sequence. The Chinese versions of the Bahman Sutra are divided into two parts, and altogether 32 short, in fact very short, chapters. But we find no such divisions, in fact, in the original Sanskrit text. Now, Han Shan, who was an enlightened Chan master of the Ming Dynasty in China, makes an interesting suggestion. According to him, the Buddhist statements in the sutra, in the Bahman Sutra, are meant to resolve the unspoken doubts of the monk Subhuti, whom he is addressing. So according to Han Shan, the actual sutra, the text of the sutra, gives only the Buddha's statements, but it does not give Subhuti's unspoken doubts in relation to which the statements were made by the Buddha. And this is the reason for the seeming, the apparent lack of connection and continuity. So in his commentary on the Bahman Sutra, Han Shan tries to spell out, tries to make explicit Subhuti's unspoken doubts, and in this way make the whole sutra more connected and more intelligible to the student. Now, according to Han Shan, there are 35 doubts which arose in Subhuti's mind as he sat in front of the Buddha, which the Buddha resolved, 17 coarse doubts which are dealt with in part 1 of the sutra, and 18 subtle doubts which are disposed of in part 2. And as Han Shan interprets the sutra, when all doubts are cut off by the thunderbolt of transcendental wisdom, then one's absolute mind, which is the mind of supreme enlightenment, is revealed, is made manifest. So much then for the text of the sutra. Now for its literary framework, especially the introduction. So far as form is concerned, the sutra is a dialogue. It's a dialogue between two persons. On the one hand, there's the Buddha. On the other, there's the monk, Subhuti. But Subhuti says very little. Very little indeed. If Han Shan's interpretation is correct, this is simply because the dialogue is mainly between the Buddha on the one hand and Subhuti's unspoken doubts on the other. Now, there's something worthy of notice here, and that is that the dialogue is between the Buddha and Subhuti. That is to say, between Gautama the Buddha, who lived 2,500 years ago, and Subhuti. In other words, the dialogue takes place between two historical characters. No mythological bodhisattvas or other such beings are involved. In the Heart Sutra, well, along comes the bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. Then in other sutras, other perfection of wisdom or transcendental wisdom sutras, there's the bodhisattva Manjushri. These are mythological, if you like, archetypal figures. They didn't exist historically speaking. But it isn't like that in the Bahman Sutra. The Bahman Sutra is a dialogue between two historical characters, Gautama the Buddha and Subhuti. And this fact suggests something of great significance. It suggests that so far as this sutra at least is concerned, we are firmly on the historical plane. We're not in some higher heavenly world. We're not in some remote Buddha field. We are here on this earth, on the historical plane. We find ourselves in this sutra in the midst of the everyday, one might even say the workaday world. And in this sutra, we are concerned with a communication, if you like, between two live human beings. The Buddha, an enlightened human being, Subhuti, a non-enlightened but a nearly enlightened human being on the other hand. This is not a dialogue between personified virtues or archetypes or spiritual symbols, but between human beings. And this is borne out, this fact is borne out, by the introduction to the sutra. Let me read the actual words. The sutra begins like this. Thus have I heard at one time, the Lord, that is to say Gautama the Buddha, dwelt at Shravasti in the Jeta Grove in the garden of Anathapindika, together with a large gathering of monks, consisting of 1,250 monks, and with many bodhisattvas, great beings. Early in the morning, the Lord dressed, put on his cloak, took his bowl, and entered the great city of Shravasti to collect alms. When he had eaten and returned from his round, the Lord put away his bowl and cloak, washed his feet, and sat down on the seat arranged for him, crossing his legs, holding his body upright, and mindfully fixing his attention in front of him. Then many monks approached to where the Lord was, saluted his feet with their heads, thrice walked round him to the right, and sat down at one side. So, could anything be simpler? Could anything be quieter? Could anything be more subdued, if you like, than this little introduction? One might say that it's almost Greek, almost Doric even, in its severity, in its simplicity. And this is significant, this is meaningful. Because after all, the Diamond Sutra is a Mahayana Sutra. And the Mahayana Sutras usually begin very splendidly, indeed. The scene of many Mahayana Sutras, as described in their introductions, is very often laid in some higher heavenly world. And we open with a magnificent description, usually, of how the Buddha sits there in all his glory on a great elaborate lotus throne, surrounded not only by monks and nuns, but by millions upon millions of non-human beings in their various orders, all in attendance. And then the Mahayana Sutra at the beginning usually describes how, before the Buddha opens his mouth, how, before he preaches, all sorts of wonderful things happen, all sorts of miracles occur. They often describe how, down from the sky, there come falling and raining great golden flowers called mandaravas that are as big as a cartwheel, and thousands of these come floating down. And then we're told very often that Buddhas and Bodhisattvas start arriving from other worlds, other universes. They've heard on some sort of intergalactic Bodhisattva radio, as it were, that the Buddha, Gautama the Buddha, here is going to give a discourse, and they come flocking in from all quarters of the universe. And then the sutra describes this. And then it describes sometimes how a great ray of light issues from the Buddha's forehead when he's in meditation and circles all around the universe, billions of miles, and then comes back and hovers over the heads of every person in the assembly. So this is the usual opening of a Mahayana Sutra. Very gorgeous, very splendid, very mythological, full of symbolism, full of light, full of colour, full of music, full of perfume. But here, in the Diamond Sutra, there's absolutely nothing of all that. Absolutely nothing. Here, in the introduction to the Diamond Sutra, everything is simple. Everything is natural. Everything is ordinary. It's even prosaic. And if we just think, if we just close our eyes, we can even, as it were, imagine the scene. We can imagine the group of huts in somebody's garden, a few miles out of the city, in somebody's grove. We can just see, as it were, the Buddha in his yellow robes, staying there with his disciples. And some of the disciples, no doubt, were not living in the huts. They were camping out in the open air, under the trees. And if we just watch, if we just imagine a bit further, we can, as it were, see the Buddha just quietly leaving his hut early in the morning, maybe at 9 o'clock, and walking all the way into the city. And then in the city, just going quietly from door to door with his begging bowl, just receiving whatever was given, a few handfuls of rice, a little curry, and so on. And then we can imagine him retiring to a grove of trees nearby, quietly eating what he had gathered, and then slowly and meditatively walking back to his hut, just lying down, resting for a while, then getting up, then sitting outside and meditating. And then we can see, then we can imagine, in the cool of the evening, the disciples from their huts, their begging rounds also over, their meal also finished, just gathering round, just waiting and just listening. And then Subhuti speaks.